Much to Leslie's deep disappointment, we are winding up our study of the book of Micah. Clearly, Leslie has loved the gloom and doom and repeated focus on judgment, and I think she may need a sabbatical just to snap out of all this stuff she's been feeling. But more seriously, we're finishing up today with Micah chapter 7. We're so eager to be done with it, we're skipping ahead to Luke. And like the rest of the book, I think chapter 7 is an honest mix of self-reflection, of the prophet taking responsibility for the ways that the community has broken covenant with Yahweh, and mindful of the ways that religious leaders and rulers can be conduits of oppression and injustice. And all the while, still clinging to God's goodness, trusting in an undeserved mercy that aims to heal creation and restore humanity to God's original intent. If you've been reading along with us and read chapter 7, you'll know the author spends the first 6 verses of this chapter wondering if there's anybody in the world who's honest or just. Creation and all of humanity just seem to be circling the drain. But even so, in light of all this, the prophet in verse 7 announces, "But as for me, I will look to the Lord. I will wait," like we started worship today, "I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me." Like he said in other places throughout the book, he's determined to do what's right despite what others do. You might remember we started this book with the idea that to hear the word of the Lord is to do the word of the Lord. And so if I'm going to listen, it's with the expectation that I'm going to actually act on the thing that I'm called to do. In verses 8 to 17, you see the prophet's willingness to also patiently endure the discipline that he feels like he and the community are under. And he decides to reframe judgment as discipline. He reframes judgment as discipline, seeing it not so much as punishment, but as this redemptive or restorative grace to help the community realign itself with God's ways. It's like Paul was talking about. We wander, and this grace that can sometimes feel like judgment is meant to pull us back into harmony with who God is and what God's called us to do. Light has a way of revealing darkness. And so rather than necessarily being a bad thing, it can be a good thing that restores us to wholeness and healing. And that leads to the last few verses of chapter 7 that are kind of the thing I want to focus on today, where he writes, who is a God like you who pardons sin and forgives transgression of the remnant of his inheritance? You don't stay angry forever, but delight to show mercy. You will again have compassion on us. You will tread our sins underfoot and hurl all our iniquities into the depths of the sea. Now I want to wrap up the book of Micah by not talking about Micah. Instead, I want to focus on one of Micah's contemporaries, Hosea. Hopefully also to stop Leslie from wanting to preach the book of Hosea, because it's even harder to preach, I think, than the book of Micah. But mostly to help us consider, or maybe reconsider, the relationship between justice and mercy. A few years ago, William Barber, who some of you may know as the head of the Poor People's Campaign, spoke to a gathering of Quakers, and he outlined this clear and specific strategies that he felt Christians in America, people of faith in America, might engage as a resistance movement to address some of the injustices in our time and place. He said, "We need a clear moral witness and to sound a prophetic voice that speaks to the condition of our society." And the Quakers in particular, because that was the audience, he called us to speak up because times are quiet and sometimes we can be quiet. But he said, "Before you do that, don't forget to be silent. Don't forget to wait before God, to wait in God, to find that clear and powerful guide, that authentic life and power that you say animates your life and directs your thoughts." so that you don't wind up speaking out of or acting out of your own ego. He didn't say this, but this is, I think, what he meant. Your own ego, your own anxiety, your fear, your need to be noticed or relevant. Waiting's one of our great strengths, but it does come with a shadow side. We can wait too long. We can just focus on waiting and never act. We can literally just twiddle our thumbs while the world burns. Inaction can be harmful to others and to ourselves. By waiting too long, we miss the opportunity to do something good or true or important or timely. But in just doing something, rather than acting out of that life and power, that virtue, that character of God, might also mean we miss out on a deeper transformation. And I've become convinced over the last couple of years that part of waiting means to wait in God's mercy. To wait in God's mercy as we work towards justice. Sometimes when I hear people talk about justice and mercy, it's if they're antithetical to one another. They don't touch each other. But the biblical concept of justice doesn't pit justice against mercy. Rather, it ties them together. Biblical justice is loving, it's merciful, it's gracious, it's generous, it's restorative. It's not passive, but it's an act of resistance against forms of justice that are either intentionally or unintentionally punitive or incomplete. As we've seen in Micah, mercy complements, it completes, and is encompassed in justice. And when it arises out of our willingness to walk in humility with God, I think the prophetic word and the action that comes with it carries this extraordinary power and true sense of timing. There's a sense that wisdom is applied in strategic ways that it otherwise may not have occurred. Mercy and justice seeking, I think, find their home in one another in really complex and wonderful ways. So the passage I want to focus on this morning reveals some of this complexity. And it's a really harrowing story out of, to me, one of the most troubling books in all the Bible, which is Hosea. If you've not read the book, I encourage you to do so. Recognizing how it reflects the atrocities of a culture of violence and a system of patriarchy that diminished and abused women in some of the worst possible ways. The book doesn't excuse any of this, but it honestly reveals a world that sometimes is just too painful to even bear. And the story is also multi-layered. On the surface, it's the tale of a prophet called by God to go find and marry an adulterous woman, to have children with her, and to become a family. So the word of the Lord comes to Hosea and gave him this command: go take to yourself a wife of harlotry and have children of harlotry, for the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord. That's a word we don't use very much, and it's hard to even say. But basically, he says, go find a partner who's going to cheat on you. Form a family and love her as any good spouse would. But know that your faithful love is not going to be returned. And I want you to do all this in a very public way, knowing full well that the people around you are not going to understand, and they'll likely ridicule you for your actions. But I want you to love this woman. Really love her, just like I love my people. And I want you to do this as a living parable. And that's the second layer of the story. Hosea's relationship with his wife Gomer mirrors the experience of God and God's people, according to the text, and it gives us a window into what it's like for God to shepherd a herd of cats. Or worse, of unfaithful people. So Gomer, the wife, spurns her husband repeatedly and boldly and openly. And again, it's a really painful book to read because you see the pain it brings to him and to her and the children. And along the way, we kind of gain insight into some of the cosmic pain, maybe, that God feels. When humans abuse one another, when they do violence to each other, when they oppress one another, contrary to the way that God has called them to be. Or when they refuse to seek justice and mercy and compassion, or repeatedly choose another idol, whether that idol is money or power or self or security. But they choose something else as the false god to happily serve. And in watching The Way of Gomer, sometimes, at least as when I read that book, I catch a glimpse of myself and I find it tremendously uncomfortable. Throughout the first 10 chapters of Hosea, there's this back and forth between Hosea and Gomer's relationship and how it mirrors or relates to the way God relates to God's people. Relentless and unfailing love is demonstrated. There's resilient commitment in the face of rejection. Love gets repeatedly offered, not because it can't let go, because it chooses to not let go. It won't let go. In the often fragile hope that true reconciliation and intimacy might actually occur. And so in the face of repeated rejection and betrayal, God and Hosea accept the challenge of loving their partner back into relationship and belonging in a family. There's no pretending that there's not a problem. Truth, sometimes really fiery, and truth with an edge gets spoken and enacted in the midst of the anger and the upset. And along the way, there's these intentional and ultimately compassionate choices that are made to try to restore dignity and to demonstrate patience and long-suffering and this relentless willingness to stay engaged even in the face of infidelity and outright rejection. And sometimes, both God and Hosea get spitting angry, ready to sign the divorce papers angry, burn the wedding certificate angry, smash the china angry, ready to be done once and for all. And so by the time you get to a chapter 11 in Hosea, the imagery shifts from a husband and wife to a parent and child relationship as a different metaphor to talk about God's relationship with Israel. And in chapter 11, things are at the absolute bottom. I mean, this thing is not going to survive as far as we can tell. It's a moment of genuine anger and fierce rage by God, which is something we don't like to think about. We may have the right to be outraged, but often we get really uncomfortable with the idea that God could get outraged. We prefer a domesticated divinity who patiently puts up with all of our mess and is committed to forgiveness and grace no matter what. Somebody needs to remain calm amidst all the chaos, and so we assign that to God. Janine often tells the story of one of our daughters being really, really angry and kind of this heated battle in our home, and the daughter finally said to Janine, you know, one of us needs to stay calm, and you're the mom. And so it's like, that's kind of our relationship with God, too. Like, you've got to stay calm here. But in this story, anger flashes and flares, and upon closer inspection, though, it's arising out of love. God's anger arises out of love. It's the longing of a parent exasperated by the surly, dishonest, disrespectful teenager who insists that you are the worst possible mother in the world. You are the most horrible father this planet has ever known. And I'm better off without you. I can take care of myself. I'm just about ready to walk out the door, but before I step out the door, I say, and I hate you. Some of us have known that in our lives. We've experienced that, or maybe we were the teenager who said those things. That's where we are in the story. And in Hosea 11, verses 1 to 4, this is what God says. This is the angry parent who's also kind of weeping over what's being lost here. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. But the more they were called, the more they went away from me. They sacrificed to the Baals. They burned incense to images. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms. But they did not realize it was I who healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness and with ties of love. To them, I was like one who lifts a little child to the cheek. I bent down to feed them. All this tender love, all this overwhelming mercy for nothing, it seems, as a relationship nears a breaking point. And we see the hint of anger that comes out in verses 5 to 7, where it says, will they not return to Egypt, and will not Assyria rule over them because they refuse to repent? A sword will flash in their cities. It will devour their false prophets and put an end to their plans. My people are determined to turn from me. Even though they call me God Most High, I will by no means exalt them. This is like God saying, fine, go screw your life up. You're so smart, you want to do your own thing, go right ahead. But don't expect to come back. Don't expect me to bail you out of the next mess that you're about to find yourself in. And then, just as the door is just about to slam closed, we come to verse 8. And God says, how can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel? How can I treat you like Admah? How can I make you like Zeboim? And then in the text, there is this holy pause, this waiting that happens. And it goes on to say, my heart is changed within me. All my compassion is aroused. I will not carry out my fierce anger nor devastate Ephraim again, for I am God. I'm not a human. I'm the Holy One among you. I will not come against their cities. They will follow the Lord, and God will roar like a lion. And when God roars, God's children will come trembling from the west. Just as the last reserves of love are seemingly draining away and fury is about to breach the heart of God, there really is this pause in the narrative. God waits, and every time I read that, the only sound I think I can hear is of angels sighing. Because something happens. We can't know how long or how short this pause lasts, but it shows up between verse 6 and or 7 and 8, because in that quiet moment, in the Hebrew, the word that's used is that God's heart recoils. It's as if there's an earthquake in God's heart. It takes place inwardly so that nothing outwardly happens. Instead, it's as if instead of anger erupting, mercy and compassion come out because God bears that wound. God bears that pain in God's own heart. And so despite whatever justifiable anger there might have been, and without any promise the child will actually change their ways or respond positively, God doesn't allow anger and rejection to be the final word. Anger and rejection are not the final word. Instead, there's this bottomless mercy and compassion that get aroused and offered. And because that happens, a somewhat bewildered an amazed child scrambles back to her mother's side at the sound of her voice. That's the imagery that happens. The lion roars, and the child scrambles back to their mother. And in any case, there's a deeper transformation that happens. A more redemptive healing occurs because God waits to act out of mercy rather than anger. And brokenness is mended when compassion in action winds up carrying the day. When I act out of anger or hurt or pain, I may feel better for a moment. And when I want to do justice on behalf of God and I act out of anger or pain or hurt, I may be missing an opportunity to work for true justice. The kind of justice that a God of loyal love and enduring mercy and generous kindness and compassion in action acts out of. And might even call me to act out of, us to act out of. When similarly faced with a challenge. Anger, I think even righteous anger, sometimes can consume people and consume situations. And I wonder sometimes if righteous mercy offers us an alternative. After Tuesday, however the election turns out, we're going to continue to work for justice as a community because we're committed to that. And I imagine practicing how to do it, how to have it tempered by mercy, will also be something that will come our way. And at least for me, I wonder if before I act or speak, what it might mean to take a moment and wait. To wait in God. To wait for God. To wait with God. Because who knows, mercy may have or may wish to have a word with us before we have a word with someone else. Let's take some more time and wait together. And if you feel moved to share with us today a word that's come to you, please stand up and one of the ushers will bring you a mic.